Welcome to the Shaman Vision Podcast. I got another great guest with me. She is an artist, an entrepreneur, and even some might call an Egyptologist. What's going on, Astea?
Hello. Welcome.
Thanks for joining me.
To be here in Shaman Vision.
Oh, I appreciate that. This is a lady that I've followed on social media. I've seen some of her artwork, and I was a fan of it. So I followed her a while back, and we kind of been connected through social media for a while. We never really met. We never really had a conversation, but I seen she tweeted something about her interest in Egyptology, and that's an interest that I hold deeply. So I was like, I haven't had a chance to really break it down on this podcast yet. So I was like, why not reach out to her and see if we could break it down and have a cool conversation about Egyptology?
I love it. And so, you know,
what was your inspiration, or what made you start to get into Egyptology?
So I was in a Catholic school. My grandparents paid for my placement in a really fancy private school, but my family was relatively poor. So I just kind of like was always an outsider in this program. And I just was in the library, and I just really kind of liked looking at Egypt books. I ended up taking out the entire shelf, and I read them avidly from like fourth grade on. But I remember specifically when I was reading about all these books, they would have pictures of mummies, and I would be distinctly very scared about it. It would be like a really sublime experience where I'll be absolutely terrified from the imagery, but I would be like
so interested
in learning and just pouring into it. So I would say my interest started very early, and it was of course, naturally, when you have archaeology, and I came into it like with the interest in, you know, mortuary science and stuff of like at the time, you would pick up the symbolism and you read the gods and the story, the mythology, the gods, and how all of them relate. And but I would say that I always had an appreciation of Egyptology and the imagery as an artist, especially for artistic lens. And it wasn't until 2013, 2015 that I started taking college classes specifically on early ancient cultures of Southwest Asia and North Africa. So really I honed in much later, but always came at it as an artist. What about you?
That's awesome. Well, you know, my interest as well started very young, very early. The first memory I have of that I could really associate with Egypt was in second grade. I was reading this book series called The Magic Treehouse. Mm-hmm. And in The Magic Treehouse, like you would go, these kids would go into the treehouse, and any book in there they read, they would automatically be transported to the time and the place where that book or story takes place. And my favorite one was about Egypt, and they were traveling around the pyramids, and there's this whole narrative and story behind it. And that's the first memory that I have of really being aware and you know, knowing my fascination with it. And from there, it just it kept building, it kept growing. And the thing I love the most about Egypt is that the more you research it, like all beautiful things, like artwork, like a great film, it keeps unfolding. You keep learning more about it. There's new dimensions, there's new depths to it that you didn't know or you never thought existed. And it just continues to inspire me throughout my life. And, you know, there's a lot of things. That's why I wanted to have you on this podcast, because there's a lot of things we could talk about in regards of Egypt. And most importantly is the architecture, you know, and the artwork and the statues. That stuff is so moving and so powerful, and how it existed through, you know, thousands of years, and it still remains, you know, out, and it's still there, and you can still see it. Even if the spirit doesn't still exist in Egypt, the artwork does, and the artwork speaks a thousand words, you know what I mean?
Yeah, what's interesting about the climate there is that it really was unique in preserving a lot of the artifacts. Neolithic, so a lot like artifacts dating all the way back to Neolithic times. So you have excellent preservation of ancient writing, which is always really exciting. And then you have a certain stability of the culture, which is much different than Mesopotamia, which was contemporary to and actually much before their writing system was developed, much before cuneiform was developed much before ancient Egypt, but it was the whole culture that was relatively unstable. And a lot of it has to do with the actual shape, like protection that Egypt has from its natural land structures. So it has mountains and it's relatively in its own little bowl. But I think a lot of people forget that a lot of the imagery and a lot of the artifacts was preserved because a lot of it is desert. The only right. fertile part of Egypt is right on the Nile.
Right, and that's what the lifeblood.
You can literally see the delineation of yeah. the desert and the grass. You can see life and birth and then chaos. You know, and it's a line in the dirt. You see it where it's fertile yeah. and where it's not.
it truly is amazing.
It's a stark climate, but also relatively stable. So we just have 2,800 years of a consistent civilization building on each other. That kind of rich history, that stability is just not even known anywhere else in like modern history.
It's not. It's completely rare and it's completely unique. So back to what we were talking about, like with Egypt and its history and how old it was. Another cool thing about that is it's debatable. You know, it can be argued that the Sphinx is 10,000 plus years old. And are you familiar with that? The study by Dr. Yeah. Robert Schock. With the water mm-hmm. erosion, I mean, yeah, the Sphinx, what do you think
might be
about
older
that?
Than it actually is.
Yeah, because there's good evidence that there was water erosion on the Sphinx, and there hasn't been that amount of rainfall since around 10,000 years ago or 10,000 yeah. BC. So, what do you think about that?
So, yeah, there is a lot of. I would say my position on that, I would say, is like kind of uncircumstantial. Like, I don't really believe in either one. I definitely do consider like the Sphinx as an amazing work of art, and it also, because it's so old, you have a whole 2,000 years of Egyptian culture. So, you know, the Old Kingdom to ancient Egyptians has rapidly, you know, even ascended the godship to scholars much later in the culture. So you have the people who built the Great Pyramids who became gods and were worshipped by scholars as gods. So you have a lot of interior mythology about these monuments, even within ancient Egyptian culture itself. So yeah. Is the Sphinx older than it actually is? I would say...
How could it be older than it actually is?
Yeah.
But I mean, let's think of that. How can it be older than it actually is? And if there is, you know, hard... Yeah. scientific geological it's evidence to, yeah. that it is dated to
There's
that time
on it.
you can't just dismiss that information. And here's the interesting thing, because people like to control the narrative of Egypt, and it's an active effort to control yeah. the narrative. They don't really want you to know too much about it. They want to keep that knowledge for the so-called enlightened ones or the Masons or whatever. But you can't deny that the what is it called? Erosion on the Sphinx. You can't deny it. And even the Great Pyramid, like, we don't know exactly when that's built. I think his name was Khufu, inscribed his name on the pyramid, and that's why they date it to his whenever he was pharaoh. But that doesn't necessarily mean that's when it was built. That just means he put his name on it, because that's what kings like to do. You know, because if you look at a lot of yeah. Egyptian architecture and artwork, the later stuff, and a lot of it, most of it, has a lot of inscriptions and writings all over it, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And the Great Pyramid doesn't. It doesn't. If you look at the inner temples, the King's Chamber and the Queen's Chamber, there's not a whole bunch. Like, in every tomb, you look in
it's very sparse.
It's very sparse, and it's very different. So, I mean, it leads me to think that it was used for something else than just a tomb. People might have been entombed there at some point, but I think the original creation of it was something different, something more.
I definitely think that the pyramids were plundered much, much early after their existence.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The extent of that plunderage and the extent of the taking inscription, because we have to remember, like, the culture is so old, so you know, whatever happened in the old kingdom, and the pyramids were the transition of, you know, there was an intermittent period of like 300 years before the middle kingdom. And before, you know, the great eras of prolific art in ancient Egyptian history. So you have so many hundreds of years, and we have erosion of, you know, even our most, even in our cities, let's say, and especially in America, you can definitely see, you know, our cities are nothing like they were when they're first colonized. And so you have to take in account that 1,000 years of people and their curiosity and their plunderage of the pyramids, the area has changed. The fertility of the city has changed. The capital has changed so many times. But of course, people love to steal and take what they can from the monuments that exist, especially if they're famous. Mentality was there too. So we will never know the answer. Because
we will never know.
Intact.
Very true. Yeah. And to comment on what you're saying about kind of the dating of the history, this is why I wanted to sit down with you and have a conversation with you as somebody who's been academically taught about this, as opposed to a person like me who's been self-taught about this. But, you know, some of the teachings I've heard in regards to the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid, and, you know, I've heard this from academics too, is that a lot of their greatest artwork was done at the beginning of their civilization and actually tended to go downwards. Their technicality and their skill at building actually went down as their time progressed. And if you look at their history, it actually makes sense, because Egypt just kind of faded out. It took a long time. It took thousands of years, but they slowly faded out to where they are no longer who they were. And so that brings up another interesting perspective and idea, because historians don't like that. They want everything to move. You were stupid a long time ago, and you gradually got smarter and smarter and smarter and smarter and smarter and smarter, right? Until we are where we're at now. But Egypt throws a curveball, and other ancient sites like Göbekli Tepe throw a curveball and a wrench in that narrative, because you see great peaks of human intelligence in timelines and spaces where they weren't supposed to exist. And, you know, I want to talk about this as well. Like, are you familiar with the Greekology class?
Greekology class?
Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't.
I haven't either. Have you ever heard of a Romology class?
Like, are you talking about Romology or like a
just
class?
Just the term, Romology. Have you ever heard of it?
I have heard like a similar term, like a ology at the end of like Greekology or Romology. Is it pertaining Rome?
Yeah, well, I guess the point I'm trying to make is, in my understanding, in my experience, you don't really hear anything about Greekology or Romology or Incaology or Mayaology.
Oh, but you have like ancient civilizations, yeah.
But you have Egyptology, and I've heard a theory that is done on purpose, because they want to control the information about Egypt. You know, you don't have these great grand disciplined studies on certain civilizations, but Egypt is so great and the information is so vast and hard to deal with that they have to control the narrative when it comes to Egypt.
I would say for like the classes of like Romology, I would say classics would cover that. And like a lot of ancient, like studies of ancient cultures, I think the emphasis on Egyptian, I think, is captured by the Western imagination the corruptibility of it. So you have like magic and you have the Egyptian influence in much later centuries, throughout the medieval period, through this dissemination of books, and all these books that, you know, they were able to get knowledge from were usually heavily, heavily corrupted tomes of pretty much monks that spent their entire lives writing and copying, and this would be considered like, you know, a very like a passion project to them that they might hide from their other scribes, maybe kept under like occulted, which is where the occult
and the occult really just means hidden from. You know, it's just hidden knowledge, hidden information.
Yeah, so there's two like studies of like, or two takes that Egyptian culture has affected the entire world. One, the culture is just so intense and with its imagery and its beauty that and so globalized and ingrained into so many other ancient cultures that it has an evolution of imagination. So everybody has their own interpretation of ancient Egypt. Now, you're right in the sense that Egyptology was only recently cracked because the language is only recently understood, and a lot of the people who had control over the narrative at the time were colonial colonists from England, British colonists. You have the plunder of monuments that are now currently at the British Great British Museum. You have monuments at the Louvre that arguably don't belong there. Because they were taken by colonialists. So right. There is definitely a control of the narrative right. because all the translators, you know, came from a European lens.
Right.
And
for sure. And I think that's so a huge point. I think that's a huge point to make, that you can't, because with our country and with our, you know, our modern times, the history of colonialism, you can't rely on these people that want to colonize you and want to put you down. You can't rely on them to tell you about yourself. You know, these people have an active interest in controlling the narrative and withholding information and only giving you what they want you to know. So you can't really, that's why as a self-taught person, I've looked to a lot of Kemetic, you know, scholars and stuff like that, who look at it from a African perspective as opposed to a European perspective. And then I weigh those two perspectives, and then that's where I could try to find some insight and some truth and some knowledge from it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I think that people forget that these civilizations were incredibly globalized for their time too. I have like a little map. I recently looked at it, the world according to Herodotus, which is, you know, a scholar at the time, a little after, I would say 100 years after the 26th dynasty, which is the article I commented on and said that was the dynasty that I wrote an article on, or the 25th.
The 25th is a great dynasty,
The like circa 700 BC, or Common Era, before Common Era. What was it getting to? So globalized. Yeah. They 100% were in communication all the way down the Nile path to Africa. They're trading. They're sending people, charioteers, to go all the way, you know, to Asia. They had not that many resources that a civilization needed, like copper, tin, wood. So they had to go really far. Lebanon, past Lebanon. Like, they were totally globalized, sending people all over the place. The kings were riding all over. We are able to learn as much from ancient Egyptian culture, especially like in the later kingdoms. Like, the 25th is at the very end of the ancient, what they say is ancient Egypt.
Right.
Because Persia comes in, invades.
And it starts getting corrupted after that. Yeah, but people start invading and corrupting it, and then the Greeks come later and invade it and corrupt it even further, and that's why it's at the state it is now.
But even before, even in the Old Kingdom, they were trading 100%.
Definitely.
Had people exploring the map, because that's what people do. They explore.
Definitely.
And they send their trade. Trade, definitely at the time, there was not coin or like set kind of currency.
Right.
All of the trading, the incentive at the time would be either resources or land, but land was primarily the thing. Like, everybody was like, I need a piece of land. The temples owned the land, the palaces owned land, and that was, you know, the economy at the time was palatial courts that allocated power to the temples and cults of worship. The pharaoh was regarded as king in Egypt, unlike
and a god. He was a living god.
And a god. Yeah. Oh yeah, that's what I meant to say. Pharaoh was a king, but he was a god.
Yeah.
He was the incarnate of Osiris or Horus, right. Osiris's son. And he was, when he dies, he will go join into Osiris. So
I mean, let's just break that down for a second. You know, in terms, are you interested in religion at all?
I am. I actually was thinking about, I was looking through the ancient Egyptian texts, and I also come from a Russian Orthodox lens, but I'm very interested in ancient religions too.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a controversial idea, and, you know, people are allowed to, you know, think whatever they want about it, but it's pretty much the truth. A lot of the inspiration of Christianity kind of came or was first kind of seen in Egypt when you have the Father, the Mother, and the Holy Son, you know what I mean? And there's a lot of Egyptian artwork that's very reminiscent of the Virgin Mother and Child, where it's, you know, Isis with horse. You know, it's the same type of imagery, and it's really interesting to see that connection. And a lot of people don't like to talk about it too much because it makes people really uncomfortable when you start, you know, comparing paganism to Christianity and seeing some of those reflections before Christianity, you know?
Yeah, I think also at the time there was a lot of Mesopotamian religions too, like Baal, that was very similar to Ra or Amun, the Thetes Amun later. And a lot of religions were kind of like squashed together in Mesopotamia, which is where ultimately Christianity arose from. I went to a Catholic school, so I, you know, learned about Jerusalem mm-hmm. and Jewish religion. Mm-hmm. Of course, when you think about it, of course, the amount of religions and amount of people that go through these lands, unlike in Egypt, Mesopotamia has a really flat plains separated between two rivers. And these plains were just invaded all the time. The turmoil was like the turnover in these lands. You know, you had the Hittites, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the old Babylonians. You have so many cultures, and Assyrians were really violent and like has like crazy murals of like slicing people. I mean, they, you know, you had the really rule in Mesopotamia with a very iron fist, and everybody had different religions and different gods.
Yeah.
You have Ishtar, you have Baal, but you also have local gods and pagan gods. At the time, there was not really monotheism, but there was definitely, I actually have the word highlighted. Let's see.
I think I know what you're talking about, where it's like a belief in one god, but he has gods under him, and so they all get respected.
Yeah, it's
Well, I mean, to touch on that point, like a lot of people don't like to talk about this
monotheism
as well. This could be argued that Egypt has the first monotheistic religion.
Oh yeah,
and there's a definite argument for that. And I mean, the Pharaoh.
I love that era.
Me too. I mean, it's like my first or second favorite. I love the 25th dynasty, but Akhenaten and King Tut, like Akhenaten. He redefined.
Just came in with a sledgehammer. He was like,
he redefined what, you know, Egyptian spirituality was, what Egyptian art was. And it's amazing. If you look, most of the statues of pharaohs and in general in Egypt, most of them, not all of them, but most of them were an idealized version of the king or whoever they're making the statue of.
Yeah.
But Akhenaten.
Heavily tradition.
Yes, and they use sacred geometry. They're beautiful. I mean, they're just idealized artwork, you know? But Akhenaten shifted that whole thing and threw that away and said, I guess paint me how I really, or sculpt me how I really look. And he looked crazy. Like, he looked crazy. He had this weird elongated head, these weird wide nose and crazy shaped face. And like his hips were wild. Like, he looked strange, you know? And he was accredited with having the first, or creating the first monotheistic religion in Egypt, which is quite possibly the first monotheistic religion in the world. And it's really fascinating because a lot of scholars have made the connection that around the time Moses was floating around Egypt was around the time that Akhenaten was in power. And so there's a lot of weird roads you could travel down knowing that information, that those two figures existed around the same time. And it's commonly thought that either the Israelites or the Jewish people inspired, you know, Moses inspired Akhenaten, or the other way around, that Akhenaten inspired Judaism. And, you know, I'll let people could come to their own conclusions on that, but it's very interesting.
The beautiful part about Akhenaten, one of my favorite parts about him as a king, was that A lot of the interpretations of the art could also, and in the writings at the time, he really considered his wife equal, and he really held women in high regard. And you could see how he painted his wife, Nefertari, and himself. They were sitting, at the time, size really matters in in iconography in ancient Egypt. The bigger the person, the more important. It's very simple. So you have pharaohs looking big, and then the rest of the story, the gods around them, people around them, very important by how big they are depicted. So, you know, when he was painted, you have the sun. You have the sun not as, you know, actually pretty prominent. You have him in equal stature with his wife
and his child.
The very proportionate to each other. And then they say that they allowed feminization and masculinization of both their features. So they, the artists were just given more license to shy away from the traditional masculine, hyper masculine depiction that they were given, and the hyper skinny African woman that they have depicted. But they really were realist, and it
they
was
were,
like
they were
definitely shocking.
Man. They were revolutionists.
All the artists were like, "I'm out of a job."
Yeah.
They were very, very shook. As in, they, the temples. So his, his, you know, vassal cult leaders.
Completely,
for his own
he scared them all. He scared all the, because the, I mean, the, for people that don't know, the Egyptian priest held a lot of power in their society. And then when Akhenaten came and said, you know, we're, there's no need for these gods you worship and these rituals you do, it's all from the Aten, it all of a sudden gives them no more place in society. You know, it gives them no more power. And that was very very scary for them. And it's really interesting because he had a short reign, but they actively tried to erase him from history.
Yeah,
the Egyptians that came after him, and part of it, his son helped. They actively try to eradicate him from history. It's lucky that we found, you know, some of his statues and
a
stuff.
A lot
so we know
of
he
his
existed.
Portraits have been destroyed around the face, and then they found Nefertari's bust, which is considered one of the most beautiful works of art in the world. They found it in like some ditch in a like crafter's workstation. It was not like in a tomb whatsoever. It was just found. So and it was also one of the few examples of provenance in art. Like the artist actually put a really nice indelible mark into the work, whereas a lot of the artists in ancient Egypt kind of go uncredited. So it was also like a really humanitarian view that the king at the time, Akhenaten, had of the world, which is really quite interesting change from, you know, the god worship and all of that.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, you know, they had kings would definitely prefer other gods, but they wouldn't necessarily dismiss other gods. That's why I meant earlier was that they don't necessarily dismiss the god and its power, but they're like, yeah, you know, or they regard the other gods as powerless, but they always acknowledge God.
Right. Yeah. No. There's a complicated history of how because people were mainly, you know, polytheistic, and it was hard to get people to change that train of thought, to get from polytheism to monotheism. It was a hard road for them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that stuff is so interesting to me. I could, you know, talk about that and think about that stuff all day. And one of the fun things about discussing these types of ideas is that there's no like real definite answer on a lot of these questions that we're posing and these ideas we're talking about. There's no definitive answer because we weren't there and we don't know. So it's just fun to go back and forth and talk about it, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think it also just helps just do some exercises to like really get yourself in the mindset of like what life would actually be like there. Because, you know, there's still people living and relying on the Nile every day. And those people do have a good idea of like what life is like in the desert. And the 100%, not 100%, but like, you know, a lot of ancient Egyptian culture really relied on stability. A lot of their art was created with the idea of making sure that chaotic forms of life, so natural disasters, the inundation of the Nile not coming, not fertilizing the lands, drought, malaria, all of the art was definitely served as a protection symbol against instability, because that's really the only thing, you know, that could go wrong for a pharaoh, is that if he's, you know, considered God, you know, he's also responsible for things going right.
Right,
so
yeah.
The natural world doesn't go right, it looks really bad. So all of their the beautiful flourishes of art, and when the thing's gone really right, the art and the example that they show really speaks about preserving stability in a culture, which I think is honestly one of the, you know, incredibly beautiful. They really believed in the arts, and inspiring their people.
Definitely.
Inspiring their towns.
You know, art and so-called magic have always been associated with each other. Like even like some of the oldest artwork they found from the cave paintings in France or the cave paintings wherever, they think there's like shamans who are doing that for like some type of magical purposes, or the Venus of Willendorf, you know, the woman, the statue of the woman they thought was made for, you know, for fertility reasons, you know, so it's
very old.
Interesting too. Connection between, statues, you know,
old.
Definitely super old. Real interesting,
like,
connection.
Isn't it like 12,000 years old or something? Just totally. I think it's older
than
object.
That. I think it's older than that. Because, I mean, are you familiar with Göbekli Tepe in Turkey?
I am actually, yeah.
That is a amazing, you know, I don't know what you want to call it. It's almost like Stonehenge, only it's way more advanced because the stones not only are huge and erected in a circle, but they also have been carved. And beyond being carved, they were reverse carved, which I'll explain it, but it's even a harder way to, you know, carve on a stone, where instead of usually if you were carving in a stone, you would just cut out a J or a T or whatever you're trying to make, but instead they cut away from whatever they were trying to make.
Is it a relief?
Well, yeah, it came out. You know, it's carved away. Is it a relief or an opposite of a relief, you know?
I think it's a relief.
Yeah.
Well, they carve everything out.
Well, they carved it away, so the design stuck out. And it's extremely dope. And another crazy part about it is, like, it was buried. You know, it was purposefully buried. So for some reason, you know, that culture wanted to bury it. But that is
12,000 years old. Yeah, I remember that culture was very obscured, and, like, everybody just left. And they had no explanation of how, you know, how fast that culture.
Right. Yeah.
It really collapsed very fast.
For sure. What do you think about the connection between like the pyramids in Egypt and the pyramids you see in South America? Do you think there's a connection there, or do you think it's just independent people coming up with similar ideas?
I think it's independent. I mean, I have to be honest, reading articles like that, where it's like, you know, I'm going to even just say it, like having higher intelligence, like UFOs or, you know, any of the, or like, you know, you know, points of the earth where you, you know, the magnetic ley lines. Yeah. I mean, those articles are very interesting. I would have to say I do come at ancient history with a different lens. So I don't necessarily put any, like those kinds of, looking into how is South American pyramids related to pyramids in Egypt. I love thinking about it, but I don't look at ancient culture that way. I look at ancient cultures, I look at their writing, I look at how their architecture lays, and I really love getting in the mindset and also trying to solve mysteries that happen. Like, why does a civilization disappear all at once?
To kind of comment on what you said, it's like you talk about the architecture and the layouts of these temples or these cities. I mean, and we got to be honest here, the Great Pyramids align with the Orion's Belt, you know, the star system.
Yeah,
or the constellation. That is true. And also, I'm not sure which, because there's multiple pyramids all over, you know, South America that have been, you know, accredited to the Mayans and different cultures, but there is a pyramid complex as well in South America that is aligned to Orion's Belt. And so when you start having correlations like that, you know, we're all entitled to our own opinion, but I think it's hard to deny that there is some connection there that is beyond coincidence.
I think when we think about ancient culture, we might think that their intelligence is more rudimentary or anything like that. And I think that's completely wrong. I think the way we think as human beings and our needs as human beings and our wonderment, like when we look up in the sky, we do see the stars. Or if you nowadays, if you don't live in a city, but
right, 100%.
You know, you would spend a whole lifetime, and we're currently living in our lifetimes. But in the ancient world, a person spent their whole lifetime in that world.
Definitely.
And with that is the baggage of a whole, you know, a small modest city. You know, big cities at the time would be considered like 60,000 people. Like, that was big.
Right.
So, you know, with these cultures with like big cities of 50,000 people, it's like wild to us that we live in such big congregations now.
Right.
You know, they all collectively sat there, looked at the sky, and they had a, you know, maybe they had their great grandparents, they had their history, and a lot of these cultures kept their history very close, so they buried the people very close to them. They delved into their own history as much as we are delving into them.
Right.
And so you have that wonderment of the modern human brain, and of course, I would say, of course, that there's coinciding monuments to star systems, because that's what people looked up to at the time. We do the same thing now.
But we're, don't you think it's interesting?
Doing it the, in a faster
don't you think
pace.
It's interesting? And we'll get off this point, because I mean, you know, we don't know the answer, but like, don't you think it's interesting on that, with that star system in particular, and then the pyramids, like them erecting that shape, that very important geometrical shape? You don't think
there's a power spaceship?
I don't know. I'm not an ancient alien type of guy, if that's what you're getting at. Even though I love that show,
you know,
because it exposed me to a lot of things.
Something
like that. Well, I think it's just spiritual power. I think, you know, we all are very aware that all these societies we're talking about were extremely into spirituality, and were extremely into ritual and magic. Like, there's no doubt about that. And so if you believe them, you said you like to read their text. Well, if you believe what they're saying that they're communing with gods, and they're getting information from gods, and that's how they have the information to build how they build and do what they do and create the religion. So if you do believe what they say, that's what they're telling you. So it's very possible that these different cultures in different parts of time are, you know, communing with the same gods or God. Or, you know, it's also possible, and I would like to bring this up too. Are you familiar with the Olmec culture in South America?
I am.
With the Stoneheads, the African Stoneheads or Asian Stoneheads, it's very possible that, you know, the African influence in South America happened very long ago, because the Olmecs were like the first.
Now that I do believe.
Yeah, and so this kind of goes together, right? Because the Olmecs were the first hardcore, even though there's very limited evidence.
I think people
so
in the ancient world really got around, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, yeah. The Olmecs were like the first heavy-duty intelligent civilization in South America on the record that we know of, and they created these huge giant African or Asian looking heads, and they left them there as bold and obvious evidence that they were there and they existed. But, you know, if you do some studies, I don't even know what you call this, but this is the study of the currents of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so
I know
on the,
what it's called. Yeah.
What is it called?
I don't know.
Oh, you don't know. I thought you said, you know what it's called. There's a current that goes off the coast of Africa, off the west coast of Africa. And if you just follow that current, if your boat's strong enough, you don't need to do anything weird. As long as you have a strong enough boat and enough food, you will land right in the Americas. You'll land right in South America. So it's not.
I believe in that a lot.
For sure.
I definitely think people were able to transcontinentally cross. Much before.
For sure.
You know, but, you know, maybe the trip back would be very hard.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
But, yeah, I definitely think that the discovery of America by Christopher Columbus or anything like that.
Bullshit, right?
All fabricated.
That goes back into a topic I've been liking
to
touch on.
Or, like, narratively not fabricated, but fabricated with a purpose.
Fabricated is a good word for it, because it's bullshit, it's lies. And I've been trying to talk about this on the podcast, the idea of all the propaganda we've been fed throughout our whole entire lives. You know, all the propaganda we've been fed, all the propaganda our parents who teach us have been fed. Like, there's a lot of propaganda going on, and a lot of just myths and lies and people trying to control the narrative to benefit themselves, but not necessarily to say the truth, you know? And I think we need to address these things so we can get a, you know, a better understanding of what's going on out here.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
I think also it's just important to develop a sense of understanding history in a way that allows you to have evidence change your point of view.
Definitely.
And I think a lot of people just simply forget that people were people back then. And, you know, you have to account for weird people mistakes and weird people motives. I'm sure that, you know, when we look at our current state with Trump at the head of the United States, people would look back at us and be like, probably like, what happened? Especially with how coronavirus has came down, and would probably consider us, we're all wearing dunce hats. I mean, I'm serious. And, you know, we won't be there in the future to defend ourselves, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean,
We have to work hard to make sure our message is recorded so that, you know, people know that, you know, or right now and contemporary in our lives to fix the problem so that people don't think that way.
Right. Well, I mean, let's talk about it. What do you think? Because you're from Baltimore, and a lot of crazy stuff has happened in Baltimore. And, you know, what do you think about these protests and this coronavirus?
Well, I was an active protester back in 2015 after the death of Freddie Gray back in April. About 2 weeks later, organized protests in Baltimore got a lot more rough, I would say. Like, there was, small instances of property damage, whatever. But the police response was just, like, really incredibly scary at the time and very unneeded, especially after the police has murdered a person.
Right.
Baltimore also has its, it's one, you know, a city with racial segregation and divides.
Yeah.
That was instituted by a very racist white class. I mean, Baltimore wanted to assassinate Abraham Lincoln when he stopped by on a train. It's a very racist town. It's never not been. There was slave owners, people still refer to some parts of the city as Robert E. Lee after the name has been changed. We definitely went through removal of Confederate statues in 2017, which is, you know, another cycle in the news that's back again with the Black Lives Matter movement. I would have never considered myself a terrorist or anything like that during these very peaceful protests. And also, these problems, you know, predate Trump.
Right.
Before he ascended the presidency. But, you know, because these problems predate Trump, this is not a chaos that's just arising from
out of nowhere,
another world. I mean, these problems have been here.
Yes, it's been boiling. It's been boiling for a long time.
Yeah, it's been boiling, and Trump, instead of, you know,
saying wise words, and bringing people together, he decided that it's a good idea to separate people even more.
Up the heat and pour salt in and make a molten stew.
Right.
He totally, and is also making this sound very fresh and very like, what happened all of a sudden? Like, why are people all mad? And it's like, you know, people have been mad since the 80s, since the 60s,
we've been brought here.
Since they've been, you know, people have been brought here. Absolutely.
That's just the truth, you know, and that's the problem. Like, people want to sweep issues under the rug. And I think that's why this whole virus and this whole protest, it's allowing people to, like, put shit on the table and analyze shit, because people want to sweep racism and slavery and Jim Crow. They want to sweep it on the rug and say, oh, we're all better now. Everything's okay now.
Yeah.
And it's easy for a lot of people to do that because they don't face those injustices. They don't see it every day. They don't have to live through it. So it's easy to pretend like it doesn't exist. But there's a whole, section of society that has to deal with that. And it's just sickening. And like, how, like, mean your words you say. You know, on the Declaration of Independence, on the Constitution, it says every man is created equal. if every man's created equal, why are there people being killed at three times the rate of other people? Why are people being murdered unarmed? It's a lie. And we can't live in this lie. Like, I believe in those words they say, so let's make it happen, you know? Absolutely. From the ground up.
The amount of trauma that anyone who's been in the slave trade or has been brought to America is just incredible. I mean, 2 million people died.
It's incredible.
Even getting to America, 2 million people have died. That is incredible numbers. That is like double the Holocaust.
Good point. You brought up, extremely, it definitely does. And you brought up a good point, the amount of trauma, you know, and trauma gets passed down.
Slaves
and people don't like to talk
here
about that.
Traumatized. They were having people look like them coming fresh off the boat, being ripped from their land. And they
hit us over the head with a club,
man.
They broke up families. They didn't let us read. They didn't let us do nothing besides work. They broke us down to the basis level.
To the animal
they want to call us, man. And that trauma gets passed down from generation to generation. If somebody doesn't step up, you know, in generations and in life and tries their best to break the cycle, that trauma just keeps going down. And then the people that, you know, once had us enslaved, it's not all of them. A lot of them are trying to see and do the right thing, but a lot of them that are in power don't want to see and do the right thing. You know what I mean? Yeah. So they just kind of keep that shit going even more. And it's like, we gotta wake up to, you know, who we really are and what we're really doing, you know, and to bring this, I love this conversation, and to tie this back into Egypt, like look at the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C. Do you know what that is?
It's an obelisk.
It's an obelisk. It's an Egyptian obelisk. Right there in the nation's capital, you know, so they want to, you know, it's a lot of complicated ideas going on. And like, even with the, I don't know what the statue is called, but the statue of Lincoln, where he's sitting in that chair, that is inspired by Egyptian artwork, you know?
Absolutely.
So these people,
because it's power. They take the co-opted the imagery from ancient Egypt because it holds that power. I mean, when you walk there, you're stunned.
Yeah. I've never been, but I'd love to go.
It's really heavily influenced by Roman architecture as well, and like granite and monuments, and they recognize the power that monuments have. And when you copy the obelisk, when you copy other monuments, Persia actually did this with its city, Persepolis and Nimrod, where they hired artisans from all over the world, and they didn't really have a culture that they built, but they borrowed other cultures during the Persian Empire. So you have a whole city built of a kind of like a mixture of like a mixing bag of all different cultures, and Persia was able to represent its power by taking its globalized influence and taking all like conquering other parts of the world to establish its power. And we're doing, you know, the leaders did that again. They saw what former kings has done, and there's nothing more powerful than co-opting imagery of the past and repackaging it as your own power.
And that's a perfect explanation of what my interpretation of what Freemasonry is, you know, because they took a lot of these old ideas and these old symbols, like even on the back of your money, the eye on the pyramid on the back of your money, they took a lot of these old ideas and for their power and got the power and knowledge from them and then took them and repackaged them as something else. And then the interesting thing about them, and I'm sure this has always existed, but they keep it secret, you know, is an active interest in keeping this information secret, which is kind of fascinating.
Well, you have fascist regimes and you have, you know, uprisings of power in contemporary where they take ancient symbols and redefine it for something else. I'm going to allude to Nazism, where they took the swastika, which is an ancient symbol, and reversed it. And, you know, being able to have imagery that people can rally by is really powerful. And when Trump was being elected, I'm a film and video major, so, you know, ancient Egyptians, and just to tie it back to ancient Egyptians really believed in the power of image. If you died without having your name on a little idol, you were considered that your ba would not find your body again, and you would go in oblivion. Like that was like your soul would be lost. So people really believed in that when you put something forth in the world, an image or a writing, that is power. Like, that's the kind of, that's what we mean by magic. That's what magic is.
Definitely.
Is that you can bring a power into the world through the means of something. And whether that be good or negative, that depends on what kind of person you wanted to be.
Yeah, exactly.
And your relationship to, you know, the afterworld and stuff. And, you know, there's different moral systems for that. But that's what magic is. And so ancient Egypt really believed that these monuments, these, any inscription that you write, if you carved the flower wrong, it would be offensive and right. would grant negative power. But imagery really does kind of work like that to the human psychology, because when you put something out in the world, so for example, Trump, when he was being elected, he had a series of like seriously cinematic movie trailers. He didn't hire documentarians to, you know, or regular PR firms to promote his presidency. He hired movie makers. He hired people who knew special effects, who knew how to write and compose dramatic cinema scores. He got people who are professionals in editing trailers for movies. And people, he believed that if you present your life as a movie, and your legacy as a movie in that language, people are going to fall for it. And they did.
It goes back to propaganda, you know?
And that's why propaganda works so much, is that right. imagery is that powerful. It and that's is. What ancient Egyptian people really knew.
For sure.
They knew.
For sure.
Imagery was power.
And they're a great example of that, right? Just how amazing their imagery is. And people still today are perplexed by it. And they love it. How do you think the Great Pyramid was built? Do you have any theories? I know nobody really knows.
I definitely believe that it was built with a system of logs and sleds. And
that's okay.
It
awesome.
Took a really long time for them to, you know, get all the granite. I think the ancient Egyptian pyramids are a feat for sure. But Queen Hatshepsut has taken and erected 4 obelisk with relief carving that you're talking about, 4 of them, and they're made out of pink granite. But the quarry that she got those, so obelisks are really hard to make. Unlike the one in DC, this obelisk was carved from stone in one piece, and they're huge. They're like over 20 feet tall.
Right.
So you have to take a piece of stone that's like 6 tons, more than that, like I don't know how,
extremely
heavy.
Yeah.
And somehow take that stone, get it to the Nile, float it down the river, up river.
Yeah.
Float it up river.
Yeah.
And then take it and erect it. I mean, people, the way that people can handle stone was, they had engineers. They were able to do it. I think a system of sleds, they had to import the wood. I mean, it was very complex, but it shows a testament of how stable and wealthy the civilization actually was. They kept their people happy. They were able to incite a huge workforce to work on one project. They were well fed. They paid people. They paid traders. They paid people from all over the world for that type of project. And all over the world is in, like, you know, Southwest Asia and Africa. So, you know, it just shows a testament to how great the civilization actually was.
Right. Well, speaking of
how obelisk, stable it was,
you know, there's one in the Vatican as well, one in Vatican City or whatever it's called. You being a Catholic, I thought you might find that cool, because it's just weird, because like if these Egyptians were, you know, so pagan and so whatever, why does the Catholic Church feel like they need to have one in their holy place?
Antiquities always has a place,
but you know, I have a
kind of religion.
I have a different theory when it comes to the creation or the building of the pyramids, and this is a really far out theory. But what I think is, the Egyptians were master, you know, scientists and master architects, and they mastered their crafts in every way you could possibly imagine up to that point. And I think that it's very possible that if you understand granite a little bit. I'm still kind of novice to this, but if you understand how granite works, it can carry a charge or a vibration really well. And if you understand how to use frequencies and vibrations really well, you can get things to vibrate, and you can get them to move in different ways, in lighter ways and faster ways than you would to get them to move normally. And I think there's something to that. When you talk about, you know, magic, and you talk about what magically is, if it's a connection, as well as what you're saying about imagery and presenting that stuff to the world, but it's also just understanding things yeah. that are complicated to get. You know, if you brought an iPhone back 100 years, people would think that was magic, but it's not really magic. It's just extremely complicated to them. And I think, you know, if these master masons or whatever you want to call them, if they understood and knew their craft, they would know how to move things and know how to do things that, you know, we just don't know how to do today. That information was lost.
Yeah.
I think it's possible. I don't know, you know, I don't know, but I think it's possible.
Sometimes I see like how bridges are made, and I'm just like, how did he do that? Like they make a hole in the water with barges and steel and all of that. Like human ingenuity is just amazing.
Definitely.
And I would say I would not place any cap to human knowledge
and potential
to any ancient culture, especially after Neolithic times. And when tools were really utilized, I think our brains are really similar.
Yeah.
I think ever since we started writing, for sure. I know it's like kind of sounds maybe dismal if, you know, 2000 years passed and we haven't gotten any smarter, but I think our ways of biological thinking of like how we interact with the world, how we wonder, how we think about art, how we want to sit down and relax, you know, all those things are inherently the same. People want to play, people want to smile, laugh.
Definitely.
They needed all those things just as much we need it now, especially in, you know, ages of the pandemic and all that. They right. also have a lot to teach us. They lived through pandemics. They
some of the most famous pandemics,
really intense stuff.
Some of the most famous actually the most famous pandemic ever happened in Egypt, you know, according yeah. to the Bible, you
yeah.
know. And you know, I honestly think, you know, what we're talking about, this situation here in America could be interpreted as, you know, something biblical or something that God has sent to us. But, you know, that's up to interpretation. What do you, yeah. you know, this is another topic.
I think it says a lot about the coherency of our culture. And we're just maybe not a super stable culture.
The American culture?
The leadership is not there.
Yeah, the American culture. I think and that goes back to propaganda, because we like to think that, you know, America is this great, great country, the best country that ever existed. But we've only been around for how many years?
370
years. How long was the Egyptians around?
2,800.
So it's like we're barely a drop in the bucket compared to the information and the systems they're yeah. in. We're barely a
half a kingdom.
Yeah, and like, it's pretty whack. I mean, it's not whack, it's just interesting. Another interesting point is, like, me, I've never met you in person, yet we're having this conversation, you know, we're able to come together and, you know, spread knowledge and build, you know, build dialogue. What do you think about social media and its impact on the protest today?
Well, social media, I would say, I try to be a positive influence on it. I think a lot of people who are protesting are doing their absolutely best. I think I stand by why I say that imagery is the most powerful thing. And nowadays we are living in a society where imagery is hyperspeed. We can be inundated with so much imagery. We are around so many people. We have never been around this many people. Billions. And
definitely, yeah.
So I think that the most damaging part of the internet is the echo chambers and the way that how the internet is just made, where it creates basically channels, basically algorithms that you fall into. Privatization of the internet by companies is really intense, and censorship. And then also just, you know, having a I'm talking about like Google and stuff, they get to choose. Or they say they don't choose, but, you know, there's SEO.
Well, that brings
up
a weird conversation.
There's people who pay to get higher up on the internet.
Definitely. So, but if it's a private-owned business, like, who would you prefer to own the business?
Exactly.
Like and the government? Do you trust the government more than the... Yeah, we live in
I think the internet has to be completely democratized. But back what I'm saying is that with the protest, I think it's absolutely fantastic and wonderful that we have journalists that are able to report. That's the most important thing. Our freedom of speech needs to still exist. Companies that shadow ban, like TikTok, companies that shadow ban, like Twitter. It's an intense conversation because you don't want fake news going out there. And I think nowadays we know all, you know, the power of imagery can be co-opted by anybody. People can say anything. But really, it's kind of like, it's sometimes it feels like to me like this really big, I don't know how like facts kind of like eroded. And, you know, there's also books and like people who like really sat down and deliberated over material and had like their backs, you know, beaten by other people to like make sure it's fact checked and stuff. And like all the materials, like there's ongoing discourse. I think anywhere in the internet that has active discourse with people from all over the place, that's a good thing. It's when people get like channel like into like their little echo holes like 4chan or conspiracy, where it's like they don't really operate by letting other voices in, or there's harassment or violence that happens. Like, for example, being a woman on the internet, it sucks. It's horrible. I don't recommend it.
I don't recommend it either.
I don't recommend it. A lot of people want to dox and, you know, go back into people's internet history. I don't care about that. I don't care about internet history as much as I care about people trying to find your IP address and exactly where you live just because you posted a selfie with like a fence in the background.
Right.
And people recognize the sign on the fence and all of a sudden they know exactly where you live, right, exactly where your house is. That is harassment and like Definitely. Really intense. And Definitely. People, you know, I have access to all that type of stuff. You can access a webcam on everybody's computer. If
right. And like your data is getting constantly stolen.
Yeah,
you know, or not stolen, but sold. It's always, you know, getting sold. And who knows, like, when these off buttons are off? Like, who knows when I close this laptop?
It's not.
If it's not still recording. You know,
so
in your phones as well. You know, it's very.
This is, like, really intense. And that's why it's so important for people just to, like, even, be able to pinpoint who the enemy is. And the enemy is not other people who are like me or you. The enemy is people who take this information and they make money from it, that they, without telling us, you know, mm-hmm. there's so many stories where someone takes something from you without paying, the corporation takes something from you without paying you. Traditionally, that's not viewed as very positive. We have like Henrietta Lacks with her cells, who was stolen by Johns Hopkins Hospital back in the 40s. And their excuse is that, oh, we just didn't have a law at the time. Well, we don't want to live in a society where we're like, we have our data stolen and companies just say again, oh, there was no law.
Yeah.
We have to hold these people accountable and
for sure.
develop the laws.
For sure. Yeah, we have to develop the laws.
We're living in a lawless world.
Of course. We're in a new space. This technology space is relatively new, you know, and there needs to be some type of conversation that needs to be had.
Protection of democracy.
For sure.
But how it
even
look?
like you were saying with the freedom of speech.
We have to fix our government, I think.
Definitely we have to fix our government. I think, you know, we're going to do that. I think that time is coming very shortly. But even talking about freedom of speech when it pertains to social media, like the Honorable Louis Farrakhan was banned from, you know, Facebook because of the rhetoric he spoke. And it's like, how can you ban him but allow other voices on there? It's just, it becomes a really strange thing when you start threatening people's freedom of speech.
I think Facebook might have been the worst thing that ever. I think I read a title of an article, like the emotional harm that like moderators go through. Like, you just, there's like so many cogs to the wheel of like modern capitalism and like, you know, how tech makes its money, but also just how companies organize themselves. That is just inherently exploitative. And I think, you know, in this era of like, for example, we have people who are on unemployment who are not, and we have like these two classes of essential workers and people who are on unemployment. fighting it out, which they shouldn't at all. It's not the enemy. The enemy is the companies here. Definitely. You know, you don't, we can't blame the moderators for making a mistake. Of course, Facebook needs to apologize for the mistake, but what do they always point at? Oh, I'm sorry, the moderating team did it.
Right.
You know, the moderating team is just filled with very emotionally harmed people who are basically minorities, like in factories, and they're all subcontracted out. They're not even employees of Facebook. They're subcontractors with no full-time rights, like PTO and stuff, who are barely associated with Facebook, who are moderating Facebook. It's not a cohesive company. It's like, it's completely exploitative. It's the same thing as like, you know, fashion companies just, you know, putting all their labor in Bangladesh and not paying them.
Right. And then selling them for crazy prices.
We can't blame the moderators. We have to blame the organization of the company that allows that kind of stuff to happen. If people were probably well paid and like for their emotional trauma for moderating, they probably would do a better job.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. I think you brought up some really good points. There does need to be a reevaluation of how this country functions and our relationship with social media. There needs to be some type of real, I honestly think it's like we need a constitution almost, internet constitution, so we could establish some laws that we feel like are valuable and that need to be followed here and in the future. You know,
like
what I mean?
A world trade agreement for the internet.
Yeah, yeah, something, you know, something in writing, something that people can be held accountable to.
The cyber glue. I mean, for real. I mean, you have scammers. You have people
the
who
cybertution.
It's just like that. There has to be a cybertution. It sounds so future, but I love it.
Yeah, I honestly think we're living in the future, man. I mean, 2020 is a futuristic. Sounds like a futuristic year. Then you see how it played out, and it's like, man, this is the future. And why I feel so optimistic about this is because I feel like, you know, this is the time to make change. If you want to see change in the world, this is the time to do it. And I think it starts from an individual level. Like us as individuals need to reevaluate ourselves, our trauma, the things we got taught in life that might not be correct. We got to reteach ourselves. We got to figure out what our values are and where we want to see this country. Because, you know, we all, I think 75% of Americans, you know, want to see people have their civil rights and want to see people treated correctly.
Absolutely.
And they don't want to see people be murdered by unarmed people being murdered by police. You know, I think we all can generally say that, and this is our country, so let's make it happen.
Yeah, we don't need an internal battlefield. I mean, there's no reason why any of these police protests have escalated the way that they have.
It's crazy what's going on now.
Like in ancient Egypt, all the monuments are still standing. I'm pretty sure they have graffiti all over them. People, tourists all over the world from ancient Rome wrote graffiti on monuments. Okay.
Right.
Like people have been defacing these monuments for forever.
I mean, even Napoleon shot the nose off of the Sphinx.
Yeah. We can recover from temporary damage.
Definitely.
But people don't recover when they die.
Definitely.
They're gone.
Definitely.
It's annihilation.
Yep.
And so, I definitely, take the stance that, you know, a little, all the response to graffiti, to broken bottles, trash, so liminal, those things compared to a human life.
For sure.
And so, I'm just definitely really saddened by the federal government response. And then also the way that we've been treating, these protesters is now the, you know, how you're treating illegal immigrants, people who live in this country who are not citizens. We've been treating them absolutely horribly, putting them in camps, inhumane things, and people have let that happen. And so now it's happening. Trump's go-to border patrol, his own police force, he's utilizing it in cities now on regular Americans. And it's because we let one wrong stay wrong.
Yeah.
And now it's becoming more wrong.
No, so, I totally agree with what you're saying. And you brought up an interesting point when you talk about how people treat the protesters, you know, how some people treat and think about the protesters. But those same people really love the Boston Tea Party. Those same people that don't like the protesters, they really love the Boston Tea Party. And for those of you that don't know, in the Boston Tea Party, some so-called patriots dressed up like Native Americans and went and destroyed property because they felt like what was happening to them was unjust. You know, and us today, the protesters today, we're not dressing up like anybody else. We're being ourselves, and we might be destroying property, or we might be standing up because we feel like what we feel like is happening is unjust, you know. But when they did it back in the day, they were considered patriots, and when we do it today, we're considered terrorists, and that's not right.
When I was in Baltimore, I seen the aftermath of curfew and feds taking in or coming in, the National Guard coming in, the one or two fires that occurred at the height of the uprising. Baltimore doesn't feel much different. It never really was that great before, but it was not like any better or worse afterwards. You know, the areas were cleaned up. You would never know. They rebuilt the CVS that was looted, and CVS bounced back just fine.
Right.
And, you know, I remember there was a Target that was looted, and it was Taco Bell burnt because someone died in the parking lot of it. And, you know, there is collateral damage when the police have, they say that they're demoralized. I think they've just always been corrupt.
Yeah.
But when there's, you know, if there's a lack of care in the neighborhood lack of care that the neighborhood has, and you know, you do have criminals take advantage. I mean, I would have to say, you know, violence is going up, and I think it's our responsibility in these communities to look out for one another. Our governments need to stop failing us and stop failing the people that they're serving, because we can't have homelessness and poverty and people starving in our cities. It doesn't make sense. That's why people are going against it, because it's like the governments are just totally failing us. There's money. Obviously there's money out there. People are reporting giant people. I mean, like Bezos.
Right. It's like billions and billions of dollars.
Billions of dollars.
And kids can't eat.
Income. Yeah. And people, kids can't eat. And so, you know, when the protests in Baltimore first began, it was because the transportation hub was shut down and that everybody came out of school. You have high schoolers coming out of school. In Baltimore, they don't even have school buses, first of all. They have to rely on, like, city buses. And city buses are, like, really tough, you know? Like, why would you have to share that? Why would you not give the kids the privilege of just being with other kids while they travel? And, like, instead of, like, the dangers of society. But whatever.
Definitely.
These kids, the whole transportation hub was shut down, so they didn't even have the buses to go home. You have, like, a bunch of kids that, like, literally had nowhere to go. And it was a nice day, and literally, like, had to walk home. People in Baltimore, the schools, the way that it works, people are not, like, blocks away from the schools. There's, like, a whole lottery system, and people end up in schools, like, across town and stuff. So, you had pretty much, like, people who had to, like, walk, like, all the way across the city that day. Of course there was going to be some nonsense going on. It's because the government shut down the transportation hub, and he had a bunch of teenagers, like, unable to get home.
Yeah.
Like, it's like the government failed us at that moment. And when the government fails us over and over and over again, we lash out. And if you're gonna, you know, affect, like, teenagers and, like, allow teenager behavior, you know, to require a federal response, people are gonna protest.
Definitely. I think a lot of people are dissatisfied. I think a lot of people are dissatisfied with the system, you know, and that's when you have a majority of the population is dissatisfied with the system, they don't feel like it's serving them, then you're gonna see what's going on today, you know?
Yeah, and when really, it's just the evidence of, like, the government really just didn't serve people. They're like, oh, we're mad that students did this and young children did this. But it's like, why did you leave out hundreds of 13 to 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds out with nowhere to go?
Right.
No, what do you think would happen?
For
Like, it doesn't matter who. I'm sure if you released 3 high schools worth of people and yeah. just let them free with no adult supervision.
Some wild shit's gonna go down.
Of course.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt about it.
It's just like, you know, you think about it and it's just like, and you know, the government likes to point fingers, and you know, of course outsiders are going to be like, oh, it's just because, you know, the black people suck, or like, you know, their racist views or something, like they can't keep it together, or they relate it to a problem that's not even their problem, and that's like horrendously damaging.
Definitely.
And I can't believe that sometimes one of the biggest, most egregious things I've seen on Twitter, just like say that Twitter can be like a really a bad echo chamber. The governor of Oklahoma, I forgot his name, got down with the coronavirus because he attended the Tulsa Valley rally that Trump had. And people say a lot of him got the coronavirus because they have a picture of him standing next to a black man. And there's like a red circle around the black man, and it's like, oh, wonder where he got the coronavirus from. Like, yeah. What the fuck? Like, what? That was like literally just so racist, just yeah. so
and stupid, just ignorant,
and stupid.
And that's where it's racism stems from, is ignorance
and anger, and just like, ah, just cringy stuff that happens, that creeps up, and it's like you're really just inserting yourself in a problem that's like not even like like, what are you saying even in that statement?
Right,
like sometimes
nonsense
racists can really create some damaging rhetoric because they're just not even saying anything that makes sense other than the fact that they're racist. But
right,
racists just
well, let them expose themselves, you know, let the enemy yeah. expose themselves. Be racist is all you want, say all the stupid shit you want so we know who you are, you
and
know what I'm saying?
Not be afraid of the internet, because people are cruel on the internet. I have to say, I've experienced my fair share of just really particularly cruel things. I think I got one of my most cruelest responses from animal rights. I took a shot at PETA because they posted a cake meme, and it was a cat being dissected, and I was like, this sucks, I want it deleted. And I told PETA, like some like vegetarian vegan was just like, I'm not vegan, but I was just like, some vegan was like, I hate this. And I was like, PETA, listen to the vegan. And then I had over 2,000 people come to my Twitter account, and multiple people find all of the posts I've ever posted about food. And like, they're like, oh, you ate sushi before, your point's invalid. And I'm just like, whoa. Like, can we just look at the writing at the wall here? Yeah. There's a cat that's being dissected that's being sold as a meme. We gotta stop that. Like, that's just really like gross and not correct rhetoric. It's just not a valid argument point. And it just dismisses like any kind, there was just no argument in the image other than to shock and appall.
Right.
And so, you know, I think a lot of people just need to sit back on the internet, realize, you know, what works as like really good conversations between two human beings, like elevate instead of take
tear
away.
Down. Yeah, for
yeah.
sure. For sure. Elevate instead of tear away. Educate. I mean, if you do see somebody that did something wrong or you think they are lacking information, give them the information. Don't make them feel like a dumbass or like whatever, yeah. because we've all been at points in our life where we've lacked information or we've made dumb decisions, you know, and we shouldn't have to be, you know, that shouldn't define us. You know, we're allowed to make mistakes. We're allowed to grow and yeah. we're allowed to have our own perceptions and our own ideas as long as they're not, you know, advocating to hurt somebody else.
Yeah, I think a lot of people get distracted on Twitter. I think Twitter is pretty bad about getting people off the point. Like, yeah, there's, like, yeah. an image, and people, like, talk on the forum, and they're like, this is my point. And then, like, at the end, it's just, like, it turns into, like, verbal attacks on each other, like, yeah. and it's, like, not about the top posts whatsoever. Like, yeah. that happens a lot, and, like, so I think it's just maybe the structure of Twitter. Although Twitter is great for meeting new people. I definitely have problems with every single social media website. I don't use Facebook. I refuse to. But, you know, like other social medias might have a better job at like getting right to the, you know, creating, you know, awareness and dialogue. Maybe Instagram has like different ways that can generate it than Reddit does, than Twitter has. And every single one of them has its pluses and its negatives. Mm-hmm. I definitely think Facebook has a big negative, but definitely. You know, it's all opinions and stuff, but for all sure. of it needs to, there needs to be like an internet etiquette course, I think, in schools.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I really appreciate you sitting with me on this podcast and sharing your information and your perspective. Nastya is a very talented artist. You guys got to follow her on wherever she – on Twitter. Is that where you like people to –
Twitter's good. Play? I'm Twitch streamer, and I also have an online shop for my artworks on Etsy under Studio Nastya. I pretty much sell my face mask and my own fashions right now.
Definitely. And the coronavirus, you need a face mask. And you got to have a dope face mask. If you're walking around with one of them lame-ass face masks, it's not cool. Talk to Nastya. She'll get you looking right. You know what I'm saying?
Handmade. Yeah.
Yes. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for joining me on the podcast. Thank you. Take it easy.
Thank you.